Mr. Henderson, reel 20.
Anything else about Brussels, Mr. Henderson?
Well, we felt... When the attack came in, when Rundstedt put his counter-attack in through the Americans, the Belgian people were frightened to death that they were going to be caught again by the Nazis, took all the British flags, the Canadian flag, the American flags, all in, and in case the Germans came back in. And when we first entered Brussels, to all the cheering and all that, we could have had anything. But we felt when we went back that the novelty had gone. They just wanted to get back onto with their own living, and we weren't needed anymore. And so they just tried to get as much money out of us as we could. We felt we were being put on. It was an awful atmosphere.
In that short time,
it was very commercialised. Very, very commercialised. Anyway, we got back there, and December the snows came. We were in action. We were in sort of action on Christmas Day, and we had anything white we could put on, any sheets or anything, which we didn't have sheets, but anything white we could get to put on to camouflage our tanks or ourselves as much as possible. We managed to get some wellies, Wellington boats. We had our zoot suits, you know, the tank suits, which were a godsend. The infantry didn't have any of these. All the infantry had were the great coats and army boots, leather army boots, especially if they're tight, bitterly cold. They never got a chance to dry out, army boots. They were leather, always soaking wet. How they survived, those lads, I'll never know. They were always wet. I mean, our zoot suits were waterproof, fireproof, supposed to be. And that is dreadful.
Did you have any opportunity? As you say, you had an action on Christmas Day, and you were in this line situation for quite a while, although in and out of it. Did the enemy try to attack you from time to time?
There was the occasional small push in towards us to try and get through, shelling, things like that, the odd sortie, which we'd have a go at, which livened the day up for us a bit. But the main action, and a lot of it, was further down, further to our right. That was where the Americans, and I think they lost about 60,000 men there, where they came through with the tanks. The guards were further to our right, and if they were involved with that, to a large extent, I don't know what the casualties were, but I believe for the whole 3 months that we were there, for all the British troops that were there, that was the Guards Armoured, well, I think the total number of casualties was 2,000 men, killed and wounded, which was quite a few. You know, you lost men, but the Americans had lost a terrible, terrible lot.
Did this, which was a major offensive in a way, did it affect your position in any way? Did you become involved in any way?
We didn't get pushed back at all. When we left there, we had the same positions that we'd held all the time. The Bulge had come further down from us, and just on our right flank, but the guards were there, and they never got through the guards.
Did you get the opportunity of a Christmas meal?
I was saying, on Christmas Day we were in action, holding the line on Christmas Day. We had the guards. And then after Christmas Day, that was our week in. We came out and we came to Shinnen. That was the village where we stopped in the school. Now, at that particular time, it wasn't like Normandy. Normandy was an exciting adventure. We were green kids going in, the weather was nice, the weather was wet, but it was warm. It was what we'd been waiting for, to get a go at them. It was all exciting, but feelings were different. Nerves were living on our nerves. We'd had enough. We'd lost so many men and good friends. I'm very easygoing and very relaxed. But a thing that happened that first morning at Shinnan in the school, we were eating our porridge. I was eating my porridge. Another boy there was a sort of a shelf, and he had a dish with some water, and he was having a wash. And as he washed, on his face, some of the soapy water went into my porridge. Normal times in Normandy it would have been laughed off, but I just jumped up and let go at him and knocked him on the floor. He jumped up and we were having a go, and we had to be dragged apart. And it was just a thing that's so much out of character for me to strike anybody that I just couldn't believe it. And when I got to, when I afterwards, my boy said, "Well, what the hell were you thinking about?" And I said, "I just don't know what happened." And this is the state I think that everyone was in. We're living on our nerves. Anyway, that particular day, it was New Year's Day, and we had our meal in this hall in the village, a village hall, and the officers served us our tin turkey and some blue cigarettes called Martins. They were in blue packets. Never seen them before, but they were Martins cigarettes. And beer, the beer was dark, very dark, and not like the beer we were used to in England, but still it was beer, and it was, we weren't great beer drinkers, I think, boys of 20. Then, and that was our Christmas dinner served by the officers, and it was all right.
Were there any desertions because of the morale? And
now we never. I've read about people going over the war and this. I never saw anybody desert from my regiment. In fact, I know there was no desertions from my regiment. And I'd be very surprised if there was any on a big scale from the infantry lads as well. That book says that there was 2,400, I think, American charged with desertion, out of which 49 were given the death penalty, but only one death penalty was given, and he was shot as an example to the others. But I don't know of any of that went on. There was certainly no desertions.
But you were having this situation where you were on edge and your nerves.
Very much so. Very much so. None of us expected to live.
Was lack of sleep a problem?
Yes. You do one on and one off. And then you might have four off. You could never get any. You never got into any settled sleep, and even when you were sleeping, it was so damn cold. I couldn't sleep. There was an officer was writing about. He wrote in his diary that when we set sail at 10 o'clock at night on his particular landing craft, 10 o'clock that night the soup that you light and it heats the soup. About half of them didn't work, so you had it cold. But if they worked, they were very good. 10 o'clock at night, the soup came round, and then I got down between the tanks and got my bedding roll. And I didn't wake up till 5 o'clock in the morning. Well, he was damned lucky. He was the troop officer. This was the troop officer. He was, because I never got much sleep. He said, and when I stood up, I nearly fell down because the weather was so rough. But that was him. I think a lot has to do with excitement, how you feel. You know, you can't sort of. But he did. And he maybe had a bottle of whiskey into him.
There wasn't much chance really to rest, because when you were out
you
of
couldn't.
The line, you were busy with your tank all
That's whatever. Right. The sleep, you were tired all the time. Tired and cold. A lot of the time your food was cold. Even when it was given to you hot. I remember when we had a cook wagon, when we, in billets, you left your billet, that place where they cleaned your boots. She wanted us to have our breakfast with her, our meal. I said, no, we're not allowed to. We've got to go to the cookhouse. And it was just across the road, maybe 50 yards. And you took your mess tin and then put your dinner in, and you'd stand having your meal. There was nowhere to get under cover. And the rain coming down and the snow, it was cold before you got it in, and eating, you know, the M&B stew and stuff. It was very nourishing and all that. But even by the time you'd carried it back to your bed, it would have been cold in a tin mess tin. So you ate it there and then on the spot, and your porridge on the morning. You know, it was warm when you got it, but it was cold before you ate it, and very little sugar in it.
Did the officers make any allowance for the fact that you know, the whole unit was acting the way it was? Were they sympathetic? Or?
Oh, I think so. Yes, especially your troop officer. Because when you were together in action, you were part of a little five-man team, and he would take his turn at making the tea on the morning, and you would all have your turn. He never did any cooking; he left that to us. But he always looked to see that nobody got any. I know, I'm talking about my particular officer. He always looked at what everybody else, that nobody got any more than he had, and we'd maybe provided this. We might have caught a chicken or something, which was looting, but he still took his share. He didn't say, well, where did you get this from? You know, he accepted it for what it was, and God bless you. But once you came back into out of the line, into billets, of course they had their officers' mess, and the attitude changed immediately. In the line, he was one of us, but out of that, he was obviously, he would come round. You still had your guards to do even when you were out. Out of the line, you still had your guards to do about every third night, guarding the tanks.
Was this the same officer that you had since landing?
Yes, yes.
What was his name again?
Hunter. Carmichael, at this particular time, was Carmichael. And, but I lost him afterwards. In fact, I lost the tank afterwards. But we come to that later on. You talk about the officers being sympathetic. I'll tell you one thing that happened. We were leaving after we left this. I don't think there's any more really to say about New Year's Day. On New Year's Day, that was the morning. That wasn't the morning that I hit this chap in the school. That wasn't New Year's morning, because on New Year's morning I was in an old mill, sleeping upstairs in a loft of an old mill, and outside was a platform where they used to bring the bags up, you know, the type of thing, on a little winch crane. And I was shaving with a mudder on the wall and a rifle parked by the side of me, and the door open, and the German planes came round. That was the last time we ever saw a German plane. And they went round and round this mill. One particular young lad, which was only young, I could see him as plain as could be. And every time he came round, I ran to the little platform and had a shot at him with the rifle, which would have picked up, you know. And then I'd get back and have a little shave, and he'd come round and I'd go up and have another. And down in the garden, I saw Darky Harris, who was the same chap, if you remember, saying, that caught one of the Hitler youths and smacked his backside. The same chap, he was a fitter. He had a Bren gun on a post in the garden, and he's shooting at them. We didn't need to think. We'd had a good drink the night before, mind. But the Dutch people were going to church, all in the best black. And as Darky opened up across the top of their heads, they all dropped flat in the snow. And when Darky finished, they all got back up and went to church. But we didn't hit anybody. That was the last. That was New Year's Day. And that last time we ever saw. And that particular morning, I was sleeping in that loft with the RSM's driver, a chap from Liverpool called Jury. And the RSM came with two mugs of tea, two pint mugs of tea. And he said, there you are. He said, lad, he says, and you can always say you've had the RSM's brought you a cup of tea into bed. So which was good. Now, that was about being relaxed. But after we left this area, on our way back up to our own sector, our own British sector at Nijmegen, We stayed in a village at night. We stopped in a village, and I was down to make water. So I ran up a passage and found an old barn and made water in this old barn. And someone saw me, an officer, the quartermaster saw me, reported me to my squadron leader. And the following that night, the sergeant told me to see my squadron leader the night before we left next morning. And he said, "You're charged with urinating in the quartermaster's stores." And I said, "Well, I didn't know he was a quartermaster's store. It was just an old barn with a hole in the roof." And he said, "Well, Mr. Sweeting was going to use that to put some stores into," he said, "and he saw you there. 3 days jankers, which meant you did jobs at night after you finished." And I said, "Could I start it tomorrow?" He said, "No." "Well, why?" I said, "Well, I'm 21 today." That was the 26th of January, 1945. And so I was on jankers. And I was washing a school out, and a sergeant came out the vestry. I said, "This is bloody good, this 21 today. See me, lad," he said, "when you finish." And he gave me a bottle of black and white whiskey, which I took back to the billet. And we drank that night. Then we moved back up to Nijmegen the following day.
Had you hit a period when supplies were getting pretty tight because you'd come a long way from the beaches?
Yeah, but we never went short of ammunition. No, we never went short of ammunition. So some of the tanks that landed on D-Day that didn't float in, the Sea Squadron HQ boys had a porpoise on the back. It was a little tractor, a little trailer on the back, full of ammunition. But they were a damn nuisance, and they just got rid of them. They got run over, they got knocked, they got the things bent. You know, they said somebody hit it. Well, it wasn't. It was when you're reversing, you know, it's like you bend the arm. I blame that. They blamed somebody. But so they got rid of them because they were running broadside down the road, which meant you took all the road up, and the infantry were walking down the road, so they got rid of them. Food we got short of. At one particular time, we were cut off for 5 days. The tip of a point in Holland, and we were cut off for 5 days, and they made an attack through, and they captured some German beef that had the swastika on, and the cigarettes were dreadful things. But we always had, I shouldn't tell you this, but the shell holes where you kept your shells. When there was the first you got rid of a shell, and then that's where you kept your fangs in there. When there was any spaces, you kept that with your fang space. We always had cigarettes in there. Tea, we got some German tea, and it was just like that Chinese tea, got just green leaves. You couldn't do anything with it. But I don't think we went hungry. We didn't go hungry. There was some plenty of tins about.
Who was responsible for getting supplies to you?
Well, I suppose it was the quarter bloke, really. The people that brought them up were the service corps, the Royal Army Service Corps.
So what were
we had our own, I think it was 186, right from D-Day. I don't know whether they were the same. They wouldn't be the same people, because we went to so many different divisions. We were the 43rd, we were the 3rd Infantry on D-Day, which would have their service corps Wallace. But it was the service corps that kept the flow of rations coming. Our own vehicles brought our ammunition up. And then in the Ardennes and the Reichswald, we had these little honey tanks with a turret off, used as ammunition carriers to get to a bad place. Two-man crew, a driver and a co-driver.
What did you think of the service corps?
I thought they were very good. We had a little bit of a contretemps at first. Compo box all have a letter on the side, you know. This is a compo box about the size of that.
This is the story about the letters, and you were always getting the same one.
We were always getting the same one. They were taking out the best ones. We didn't know which was the best. We didn't know. We thought they were all the same, until it was accidentally. That was the only thing we had. After that, we had no more bother. They got through all right. They were grand. They were a bit scruffy like, But they weren't cavalry style. They weren't proper Cumberland Time men. We didn't speak to them much. They did the job, and that was it. They were all right.
So you moved up to your Nijmegen area.
I don't think there's any more to say about holding the line down there. You can't explain how bad it was. The weather was the biggest thing down there. It was just absolutely dreadful, and we went on leave from there. That was one thing. And anyway, we moved back up to Nijmegen. Now this is where we got a draft. The reason I remember it, you brought it back to me by asking, was that there was one coloured boy came, and he was a West Indian, and a very very nice lad, but he was he mixed with everybody, and were sleeping in a school. And I went on guard that night, and how I remember this particularly, because I met a girl called Hetty, and she stayed with me while I was on guard, and we did a little bit of kissing in the doorway for the 2 hours that I was on sentry. But anyway, in this school was this West Indian boy who'd just come as a draft with a few more replacements. I never saw him again. He must have been killed. I think he was killed in 3 weeks. I never saw him anymore. They said he'd been killed. So he lasted about 3 weeks, I think.
Any racial discrimination?
No, not a bit. Nothing at all. He was a very, very nice lad. He was the first one we'd seen. And he slept with us in this school. And he was a laugh. You know, he made people laugh. That's all you wanted. And then from... I don't know how that was, January 26th. We were moving up the 26th of January. We weren't in Nijmegen. Nijmegen, at that particular time, was like the English coast before D-Day. It was packed. Everywhere you looked, there was people. There was troops. Everywhere. I remember a concert party coming up. We went to a concert that night, one night in Nijmegen. There was a big club, Naffy, with two Canadian Graves in the grounds. There was a big, either shelling or, it must have been shelling. And everyone sort of was a bit worried about these things. Some of them, some left, but the concert party still went on. I never left. And then we moved out of Nijmegen after a few days into, more or less into Germany, to a little, the start line sort of thing. And then in the morning, and that night it was just a village, we got shelled, and a lad called Wills, a London lad I remember, got a piece of shrapnel in his back, and down he went, and when they got him on the stretcher, he was laughing and sitting up, and he said, "You can all kiss my backside," he said, "because I'm going home, and that to the lot of you." And off he went, and we was all saying, "You jammy bugger," and all this, and when I never saw him again. And I thought, well, if he got one right in the middle of his back, his spine, he'd probably be crippled for life. But I've heard within the last year or two that he's all right, and he's still alive in London, Wills. So I hope if he ever goes to the Imperial War Museum and looks at this, he'll remember Hendy. Anyway, at that particular night we walked, two girls came up. This was just the start line. It was out, there was nothing about anywhere. And two girls came, and we walked them back. Her parents, and a lot of families were all living in a little village hall. They lived in the corner.
I think we've got this story.
We've got that one. That was where the start line was. Now, we went back, and about 5 o'clock in the morning, they said that the biggest barrage went up ever. I forget, there was... The build-up, I think, had been going all over winter, preparing for this big barrage. And at that particular time, they said that the British artillery were the finest in the world, a creeping barrage. And it went on for 2 days. I don't know how many shells they fired, but it was a terrific noise. And then we moved into the Reichwald Forest. Now that was far worse than anything that I've ever seen.
Can you describe the terrain? Obviously it was a forest, but you know, was it up and down, or was it flat, or was it dense?
It was more or less flat. The Reichwald Forest.
Pretty thick with trees, was it?
It was thick with trees. It was impossible for tanks, we thought. Impossible. They thought that the trees were too thick to push over. We were with... I'm sure that we were with the 4th Welsh. Not the W-E-L-C-H. Welsh. The 4th Welsh. I'm sure that at that particular time we were with the 4th Welsh. If I'm wrong, I apologise. Because it's a long time ago. But the biggest problem here was the mines. It was sown like a crop, and there was mines everywhere. You didn't move for mines. Dreadful. Took a terrible toll. The infantry, they had a terrible time of it. The Welsh regiment. Another time, at this particular time, we were also with the Rifle Brigade in there. Now the Rifle Brigade was a 3rd Div. So whether they'd left the 3rd Div or what, I don't know, but they were. And that was the worst fighting we ever saw. Shelling, we got shelled to bits. They were fighting like maniacs. They weren't going to let us in. We were going into Germany. And they were determined we weren't going to move. We weren't going to get into Germany. For every tree you nearly had to fight for. There was one chateau. There were Scottish. I think it was the Black Watch or somebody had tried to get into this chateau, and they lost nearly a whole company trying to get into this chateau, to scale in the walls and that, to try and get in. And when they eventually got in, it was only being held by 15 German paratroop lads. That's all there was holding. That held the whole regiment up. Very, very brave fighters.
Were you confined to the tracks through the forest?
We were, yes. Because of the muddy conditions. Now, when it became very, very hard frost, then we could go off. It was really, really wet with melted snow and things like that. But when the very severe frost came, that was better for us.
What are your own personal memories of being in there? What were you doing and seeing?
Frightened to death. All I could think about was mines, going up and losing my legs or something on a mine. I was frightened to death. They said that there was 250,000 mines lifted in the Reichswald in 1980. 250,000. Had been lifted in 1980, I was reading somewhere. So you can tell how many there was. And the mines were when we came out of the Reichswald, and you were in the villages and the buildings, you didn't go into a building. Toilets, dead bodies, even a dead body was booby-trapped. And double ones, you know, you'd get one and that would... And when you lifted it, he'd set the other one off. There was this crafty, dirty... I think mines are a horrible, horrible thing.
Did you lose anyone that you know of?
Oh, yes.
On mines?
Yes. There was one young lad that was killed there. He was only 17. Now, I don't know this lad personally. I don't think, but his driver was telling me about it. He must have been one of the replacements that came at Nijmegen. He must have been one of those that I maybe saw him, but I couldn't picture his face. But they said he was only 17, and he's buried in the Reichswald. I would like to go back and see the graves in the Reichswald.